good afternoon, and thank you for joining us here at KMXT 100.1 FM's Talk of the Rock. I'm your host, Dylan Samar. Joining us today is Tim Richardson, Director for Government Affairs with Wildlife Forever. How are you today?
I'm good, Dylan, and thank you for reaching out.
Absolutely. So we were going to talk about the recent segment of decisions by the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council, but in order to just get a little bit of introduction about that, tell us about the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I'm sure everyone's familiar with it, but and how it impacted the local economic and ecological life here on Kodiak.
Well, the Exxon Valdez settlement created a $1 billion settlement that was distributed by state and federal trustees over the years. And a lot of things happened on Kodiak, including the Fish Tech Center and things in town. But the biggest economic impact was a series of land deals, both purchases and conservation easements with native corporations inside the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge and on Afognak Island that were really during the Clinton administration primarily, but begun by Walter Hickel. And they probably are in the range of over $300 million. And a lot of the corporations sold some of their lands and sold some easements, but that no corporation sold out all of their lands. And the money from those sales really helped build native corporations into the powerhouses they are today.
So let's get into some of the environmental and the environmental impacts of the spill and how that affected conservation efforts in Alaska broadly and the local wildlife.
Well, when the spill happened, people who remember the visuals and the video of the terrible tragedy in Prince William Sound and that oil came slinking down into the Gulf of Alaska. It was devastating in the Barren Islands. I think it killed 275,000 common murres. They were coming back at that time of the year, which was late March in 1989. And then it's washed around Kodiak Island all summer. And it actually went down the Shelikof Strait and below Kodiak and then up the east side and fouled beaches on the southeast side around Old Harbor and Akiak. So it was a strange time. I mean, the eagles were dying from eating carrion, you know, in the water. And it was really, nobody really understood the impacts at that time. But it had a very eerie feeling.
Right. So your involvement with what we're going to be talking about today sort of begins around this time with the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So can you tell us a little bit about what was happening like on the side of the government while this whole thing was going down?
Sure. So Exxon was sued by the state of Alaska and the federal government. And the largest settlement in the history of the Clean Water Act was registered at $1 billion. There were other laws like the Natural Resources Damages Act that were all passed in the 1970s under the Nixon administration. And basically the way you pay for or the way you document what you should do with the funds is you establish a link to injury between different species that were injured, like harbor seals, like sea otters, like harlequin duck, like pink salmon, red salmon. They had about 20 different species, black oyster catcher, that were injured by the spill. And the rationale for buying coastal areas and protecting coastal areas on Kodiak Island and elsewhere in the spill region was to have a reserve of healthy nesting, feeding, and breeding areas for fish and wildlife injured by the spill, and those species would repopulate the more damaged sections of those species further north. So it was a link to injury, and my job really for Old Harbor and Old Harbor Native Corporation and Akiak Kuguyak was to take people around and show them the various land parcels that had those attributes, good for salmon, good for birds, and good for sea otters, and also land otters were an endangered species.
So I suppose the next question is, I guess I'd like to ask you a bit about yourself and how you ended up doing that kind of conservation work on the government side.
Well, okay, I'm born and raised in Michigan, moved to Texas in 1979, became a journalist down there, and then got hired by U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson, who people might remember was on the vice presidential slot on the Dukakis-Benson against Bush Quayle in 1988, and then I became chief of staff for a member of Congress from Texas, Greg Laughlin, who was on the Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee. And I didn't like the fact that he got that committee assignment because my job was to raise the funds, and you couldn't really do that well. But lo and behold, 90 days into his tenure, the Exxon Valdez happened, so my boss had oversight for the spill. And I had been coming to Kodiak to visit Len Kimball, my high school friend and college roommate, who was the building inspector for the city of Kodiak for many years. And I've been coming to 83, and then I could go ahead and, after meeting Old Harbor Native Corporation, work for them and AKI. And just, you know, it was a great privilege to get involved, and really the highlight of a career that now is... 30 plus years.
So let's get into the main topic for today, which are some of those recent decisions made by the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council. So can you talk a little bit about some of the decisions that they made and some of those decisions that impact conservation efforts?
Well, starting with the positive, which was the Aleutic Museum getting $8 million, which is going to help them out quite a bit. The shocking part of and disappointing part of the meeting was a rejection of three habitat projects in the Kodiak Archipelago, which blindsided the supporters, and the three state trustees objected to it. They would have passed easily with the federal trustees. But one of the three, the most expensive one, was $10 million, and that was with the natives of Kodiak up on north of Fognac on a land parcel that would have connected extensive acres on the east side of a Fognac with extensive public land acres on the west side. And that's right next to the Red Peak unit of the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. It's 50,000 acres. Shuyak Island State Park is 50,000 acres. So you would have had about 220,000 acres connected. You could walk on public land from the east to the west. And this is a dream that Governor Walter Hickel had, to have a world-class coastal rainforest park on the north part of a Fognac tied up with Shuyak, which would be a great thing for recreation, but also for the tourism industry. And he first proposed that, and we've been working on it for many, many years, both with landowners, a Fognac Native Corporation, Yuzinki, and others, Koniag. Frank Murkowski had vetoed Paranosa Bay project back in the late, basically about 2003, I think. And we were able to, through Senator Gary Stevens and the then State Representative Dan Ogg, reverse that veto. And then Sarah Palin came in, and she put more Exxon Valdez money in there. So the Hickel dream and our goal for hunters and anglers and outdoor recreationists was advanced. And then we were waiting for this deal to happen. And Natives of Kodiak has been working on this at least since 2009, I believe. Very patient, staying at the table, working in good faith with the trustee council. And to be blindsided like that and rejected is very rude. It's very impolitic. And it also keeps $10 million out of the Kodiak economy, because their shareholders and their corporation would invest a lot of that money. I think that David Anderson mentioned, the president of NOK, mentioned doing a sewer project on their property near the Buskin River in town, creating even better and more development interest, and also possibly state park up there. It's a gorgeous spot. So you could have had $10 million invested into Kodiak, including things like buying ATVs and buying groceries and paying for college educations and that kind of thing. So that was a shock and completely needless, because there's $62 million in the habitat account that's been established since 1995. That's how much remains in habitat. And $10 million would have finished off the north coast of a fog neck. You also had Fort Abercrombie State Park being able to develop more park area, get more park area. You know, Dylan, I know you're kind of new to Kodiak, but it can be claustrophobic sometimes if you can't get out of your car and walk on public land or recreate. And so this would have been a beautiful new park addition, and it was about $7 million. The city of Kodiak, I believe, owns it, and they would have been able to use that money to do, you know, pay off the high school that you guys are in deep debt because the governor cut the state funding for that. It would have solved problems in your local economy. So the idea that you're going to kill it for economic reasons doesn't make sense. Okay, there's $7 million. Then there was a proposal that that Tom Panameroff said was under consideration by Kodiak out at Woman's Bay for, I think, $3.3 million that would increase public access. The board had not signed off on that yet, but it could have gone to the board as an approved project from the trustee council. So that's $20 million out of the 62 remaining in the habitat that would have come to Kodiak and would have improved the economy. The state trustees did not explain their action. They did not announce it beforehand. They did not prepare anybody for it. And I think it's worthy of a resignation by Jason Bruni, who is the commissioner of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, who ran that meeting. And he runs a good meeting, but he should become a lobbyist for oil and gas or other development interests and should never go to work where Department of Environmental Conservation is on the door.
So can you tell me a little bit about your work on developing that plan?
Well, basically, I've been a helper to Native corporations for the first 7 or 8 years, and then that is helping them understand the laws, helping them introduce their, introduce people to their properties, and work through the rigmarole of politics, which, it's not their favorite thing to do. Commercial fishing villages, and they're very busy already, so they need somebody to help in Washington, in Austin, Juneau. I work in Texas now, but in Juneau. And I sweat the small stuff for them. I never made any decisions or even set the priorities. They had the priorities already in hand. But so I was grateful to be able to help tell their story, which was primarily my job. Then I've worked for nonprofits like the American Land Conservancy and now Wildlife Forever. I worked for the Kodiak Brown Bear Trust for a number of years and recruited the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and a host of other hunting and fishing organizations who all wanted this to happen, including the Alaska Outdoor Council, including the Alaska Territorial Sportsmen. And to be blindsided by a governor who purports to be a sportsman's advocate was a shocker.
So we got into a bit about some of these other improvement projects. Another thing I wanted to ask you was a little bit about the history of public lands and their sales locally on the Kodiak Island.
Well, you can go. It's a fascinating history because you can go all the way back to a settlement by natives here, Aboriginal people, 7,000 years ago or thereabouts. And then you have the Russians come in 1784 and they established Kodiak, I think, in 1790 or 91. And then it sold. This land was claimed by the Russians, but then it was sold to the United States in 1867. And a condition of the treaty was that lands of the Aboriginal people who were at that time Russian subjects would be retained by the local people. So the Russians said, yeah, we'll sell you this, but you have to honor our citizens. So they did. So native claims were going to come out of U.S. ownership, U.S. territorial ownership at some point. But people didn't deal with it until after statehood. Then in 1971, this is 104 years after the treaty, you have the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act pass. And this finally honored the Russian condition in the sale. So Native corporations were deeded land based on population. They made land selections, and sometimes they over-selected because you had to sort out exactly what you'd end up with. But they ended up with 70% of the rivers in the Kodiak Refuge, for one, up on a Fognak. I don't know a statistic that tight, but they got a significant amount of the best salmon and forest areas on a Fognak Island. So that was 1971. 1980, another big slug of land goes from the federal government to Native corporations for people who were left out of the Claim Settlement Act. So you had a massive transfer of ownership to private entities, Native corporations, who were told by Congress, go make money from these lands because you're not reservations. We're not going to pay you every year to be on a reservation. You're going to need to use those assets in an economy. So they did. But the biggest boost they got was selling some of them, selling selective, at least in the Kodiak Refuge. Up on a Fognak, there was extensive logging that the Forest Service was going to go ahead and do anyways. But when it was deeded over to Native corporations, they did it and, you know, thrived and built their corporations. We looked at areas, particularly under Anilka lands, where the Native corporations do not have trespass authority. They were willing to sell timber on the northern part of Fognak Island. And so that's how we began to get the public support with Native willing seller relationships, and the natives got paid as much for the land as they would have for the trees. And then they've invested those funds into becoming really major corporations.
So now we're here at the modern day, and, you know, we've just had this these decisions by the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council. So what happens now? What's the next step?
Well, when Governor Murkowski vetoed the Paranoia Bay project for $20 million, almost exactly the same amount that Dunleavy's trustees rejected, there was a backlash in the Native community, a backlash among sportsmen, hunters and anglers, and conservationists, the Audubon Society. And it got so hot that with the very strong support of Dan Ogg and Gary Stevens, Representative Ogg and Gary Stevens, their strong support forced Murkowski, with all this public, you know, with the parade of the things I just mentioned of supporters, they got Murkowski to put $4 million back in from a separate federal account. But he said, no Exxon Valdez money. Well, it was a bad fallout for him, and Sarah Palin beat him in the primary. She ran and got elected, and then she restored the funding. So you have several governors trying to get this done. I'd have to give Frank Murkowski some credit for listening to Gary Stevens and Dan Ogg at that time and the local community. It was wall-to-wall support on Kodiak and in the nation to reverse his veto. The Washington Post said he's the only guy that disagrees with this deal. So it became a national issue. And he had appointed his daughter, Senator Lisa Murkowski, to the Senate. And she was coming up for her first reelection. And so it was beginning to get a little bit hairy. And he did the right thing. And then Sarah Palin did the right thing as well. So we're hoping that some history could repeat itself. I know that Louise Stutes is the Speaker of the House in Juneau, the state legislature. Gary Stevens is still there. I would like to see them call for a public hearing on Kodiak Island and invite the governor, invite the state trustees to hear it out. What is his position? Because it certainly doesn't pencil in terms of money. What he did there to keep land private is not going to create more money than what is already would have been done. It was approved by the Public Advisory Committee. It was approved by the staff of the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council. It was approved by the federal trustees, and the landowners, at least in the case of Natives of Kodiak, they were in that deal. And the city of Kodiak was also in the deal. Kodiak would have had the opportunity to have their board decide on it, but he just pulled the rug up from underneath them, and that shouldn't stand.
So are there other projects that are similar to this that the local Native corporations have been looking at doing for some time that might be up for consideration in future trustee council meetings?
Well, I really don't know of extensive other lands. There might be some forest carbon conservation activities. There are a few parcels of great significance. Like Long Lagoon on Paramount Peninsula is an outstanding property owned by Kodiak. Land sales per se, this kind of might have been the last of the land sale effort. And the strategic importance of the north of Frognac area, to be able to walk across the Portage Lake and Portage River east to west, that's unique. I don't really know of a whole bunch of other land sales opportunities on Kodiak.
So I think that covers very well the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council and their decision. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work in conservation in Alaska. What are some of the other issues that you've been looking at and things that are on your mind?
Well, I worked extensively on the Tongass National Forest in support of the roadless rule, which means you protect old growth forests in the Tongass, 18 million acres. But really the most important acres are the low elevation stream banks, which is where the big trees are. It's where all the animals are, the wolves, the bears, the salmon. The Forest Service used to sell that off, subsidize roads into those areas and let contractors cut old growth forests and sell them to Asia. And it was a loss to the U.S. taxpayer. That was stopped by the roadless rule under the Clinton administration. I worked extensively on that. Again, primarily working with hunters and anglers, bringing them into the battle. There was also on a Frognac, carbon sequestration deal that was done at Paranosa Bay was the first forest carbon project in Alaska. And subsequent to that, there have been huge deals done by Sea Alaska, done by Otna, done by the Chugach Alaska Corporation. So I'm proud that Paranosa Bay was the first forest carbon project. And so it opened up a new revenue source off trees by keeping them standing. And that helps your biodiversity in all your different species. And of course, I've done a little bit to help out in the pebble mine battle. Again, mostly going after the hunting and angling folks who have a lot at stake out there. So I'd say, right now I'm working on the Bering River coal field that was approved at the trustee council meeting by the federal trustees to get appraised. And that is very happily is now headed in a direction where you could buy out the trustees, the federal government could buy out coal interests in the Bering River coal field in the Copper River Delta, which would stop mountaintop removal mining in one of the most remarkable wetlands. It's the biggest wetland on the west coast of North America. And it's going to be great for salmon, great for recreation, great for hunting and fishing, and not destroying a massive, there's 12 million birds that fly through on those wetlands right out front of the Copper River. So they're going to be a beneficiary.
I wanted to ask you as well about some of these different projects. Can you talk a little bit about your work and how Wildlife Forever is involved in some of the other efforts that you guys have around the country?
You bet. Well, our mission is habitat protection, conservation, education, and we basically wildlife management. So a big focus of ours is invasive species. We're the number one invasive species nonprofit in the nation. And basically, we work with state and federal agencies and other partners, cities and counties, to keep invasive species out of our lakes, out of our streams and rivers, and on the landscape, so that we have biodiversity. The heritage of biodiversity in North America will be maintained, as opposed to turning into basically a biological desert. It might be cheatgrass in the west. Keep the Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, which would be a devastating effect if they ever got in there from the Mississippi River. And there's there's a wide variety of threats coming from invasive species. They diminish the richness of American biodiversity.
I'm sure then you're familiar with Kodiak's crawdad problem.
No, I'm not. Is that a new one?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, relatively, there have been probably for one, maybe two decades, there's just been a population of invasive crawfish that's just been in one of our lakes, and they're eating up salmon eggs.
Oh, my God. Where is that at? At Heitman Lake or
that's
something?
That's Buskin Lake, I believe.
Buskin Lake? Oh, that's terrible. Yeah, you can see. So you're feeling the impacts of invasive species right there.
Certainly we are. It's, well, I can only imagine that the invasive species problem is only going to become more pronounced over the next few years.
It's a crisis. And then you add climate change, sea level rise. We need to be completely focused on really shoring up our biodiversity. You know, you see in Washington an infrastructure push. We have a World War II type mobilization to help the American economy, and a lot of it's the underclass that hasn't been, in Silicon Valley and hasn't done all the good technology stuff, but regular working folks, and they need help, and that'll come from infrastructure. But part of that bill will be $55 billion in water projects. So you could look at maybe the crawfish eradication and Buskin from that bill.
So we're down to our last minute here. If folks are interested in helping you guys out with your mission and communicating with the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council, where can they go and do that?
Well, they can contact Wildlife Forever. Wildlifeforever.org is our website. And they could also call me, 202-352-1269. And Dylan, you can leave that. Anybody wants to get in touch with me there at the station, 202-352-1269. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to contact Speaker Stutz and Senator Stevens, get their counsel, and then see how we can bring reason to this this debate. But I think the governor's position is not going to be widely accepted.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, Tim. I greatly appreciate it. I hope you have a great day.
Okay. Thank you.